Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. This episode contains descriptions of sexual assault, sexual violence, and rape. Listener discretion is advised.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Lizzie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am very well.
So I'm a little nervous about our topic today.
Oh, okay.
Because it's to do with sexual offending.
Yes.
And I know that I will get to a point where I talk about rape culture.
Yes.
In Australia. And I know that we have divergent views perhaps on that particular issue.
Yes.
Linked to your other favorite, toxic masculinity.
Well, I think it's your favorite. I have some question marks over it, yes.
So let's just brace ourselves
okay.
for what might be ahead.
Some fireworks. Right. Let's jump in.
But so I obviously, well, not obviously, but part of my area of research interest outside of domestic violence is around rape and sexual assault, and very specifically about the defense of mistake of fact that's often raised in rape cases.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about that so much today because a very recent news article that I read made me think of a different part of sex offending and rape offences that also needs a little bit of attention, and that's the context of offending within universities and colleges.
Yes.
And the lack of adequate response by institutions, the lack of reporting either to the institution and, of course, then even less likely reporting to the police. And so I just thought we could talk about that a little bit and see what has been done or might need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But so I was reading an article that was referred to me by a colleague, and it related to, it's from the US,
yes,
related to a 2020 complaint that was filed by a student. It's called a Title IX complaint of sexual assault, and it was against two male classmates.
Mm.
A year later, after the complaint was lodged, the university, it was the University of Maryland, found the men not responsible for that offence that was brought. And I looked it up on the US Department of Education's website, and a Title IX complaint requires schools to adopt and publish grievance procedures for students to file complaints of sex discrimination, including complaints of sexual harassment or sexual violence. And then they can use general disciplinary procedures depending on the outcome of the investigation.
Yeah. So I just wanted to jump in there because I sat for a little while on a university disciplinary committee, and I, as a lawyer, was interested to know what the sort of the, what are the legal tests, what, how is it all legal? So the universities have codes of conduct for students, and it's really part of a contractual arrangement. You have, you pay for your subjects and your teaching, you agree to abide by a whole series of rules that the universities have. One of them is a code of conduct, and then within that they have, you know, rules about what you can and can't do. So my guess is that, you know, these grievance policies are being lodged, you know, under that, these behavioural codes.
Yes, I think so. And so they investigated, they found no basis for the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So then one of the students who had been accused of the sexual assault filed a federal lawsuit alleging that he had been defamed because after the complaint was lodged, students running the Preventing Sexual Assault campus student group had made public information about the complaint.
Yeah.
He said they had undertaken a campaign to ruin his life by calling him a rapist and stating that he was still under investigation, even though the Title IX claim had been dismissed.
Yes.
And so that defamation case, as far as I can tell, is still pending, mm-hmm. but it had made the news.
That's not strange. We've seen almost very similar circumstances in Australia in relation to not on-campus sexual assaults, but more public accusations of sexual assault and rape, which have ended up in defamation hearings.
Well, and Johnny Depp and Amber Heard.
Oh, of course.
So yeah. He won his defamation suit, even though the charges she had alleged had been proved in a British court.
Yes. Were they criminal charges in the British court, or was it a similar
defamation? I think that was civil.
Civil, yeah, it was a civil suit, and then it was a civil suit in the US. I don't think there was ever any criminal charges.
No, but he won, even though she had won in the British court.
Yeah, there's some funny rule. I remember talking to a friend of mine who'd practiced law in America about you, because in an Australian court, you just roll in with the British judgment saying, mm-hmm. well, this has already been proved. But I think there's some rules in the United States they won't recognise that.
Cross-jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And so then I saw in June 2023, the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled 7-0 that a former student at Yale could be sued for defamation based on allegations of sexual assault that she made to campus administrators. Mm. They ruled that unlike the immunity that survivors are granted for allegations made in a criminal prosecution, a survivor's Title IX accusations are not protected because the accused has fewer rights.
Mm. Well, I think the policy reason behind those is that accusations of rape or sexual assault are incredibly damaging to somebody's reputation, and they're easy to make and hard to disprove because rape and sexual assault tends to be a crime that happens in private. So there's not witnesses, so that it really is a what we call a he said, she said case. So I think that's one of the reasons why defamation courts or the law is happier to step in and protect or at least entertain the idea that there's been some defamation.
Which I do understand that. But so then it made me think, because also the rate of conviction in a criminal court for rape and sexual assault is incredibly low, 1.6% or something like that.
Yeah, I remember that statistic. Wasn't it that 1.6% got to trial? It wasn't once they were at trial, they only had a 1.6% success rate. I think once they're at a trial in front of a jury, they've got a 60% chance.
No, I think conviction rates are very low. But I mean, it is enough to deter someone from going through the process, because different episode we'll talk about,
yeah.
But it's very difficult to bring charges in criminal court and go through that process knowing that the chance of any kind of outcome at all is slim. I'm saying that as a woman.
I don't disagree with you, and I think that the statistics bear out the idea that the process is something that is a deterrent for people making complaints.
Yes.
I'm not sure how many people are going, it's unlikely to be convicted if I get to the end of this process. I understood the statistics were that the process is difficult, and so that it's the process that deters people.
Well, anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
It's difficult in criminal court. And now I'm seeing it's also difficult in a non-criminal context. So if you are at university, also more particularly if you're at a residential college at a university, and something happens that is potentially a sexual offence of some kind, A, the processes are, I don't think, suited for purpose. But also, you know, we see that if they're not borne out, you're then going to be dragged across the coals. And so the impetus to complain is very low. And so they are very low reporting rates.
In the example that you gave, it wasn't that there was a complaint made and that was all. It was the complaint was made, investigated, dismissed, and then the victim or the woman who made the complaint, she then made public statements about it, which is a different kettle of fish.
A group did. But yes, I understand. It's complex, but it got me thinking.
Mm.
And so I thought I'd have a look at sort of the problem we're facing globally, I think, in terms of offending in universities and colleges in a sexual context, okay? And I want to start with two really famous US cases and their outcomes. The first that I'm going to talk about is the Brock Turner rape case. I don't know if you remember this, but back in January 2015, and we are at Stanford University.
Yeah.
There were two Swedish graduate students out for a bike ride, and they were biking past the Kappa Alpha fraternity house, and they saw a man, this Brock Turner, who was 19, a freshman at Stanford, raping a 22-year-old half-naked woman behind a dumpster.
Mm.
The images are burned into my mind. I remember this case very clearly.
Mm.
So the victim, who was a recent college graduate, had been visiting her sister, who was then an undergraduate at Stanford as well, on the night of the incident. She had originally intended to spend that night at home but changed her mind and attended the fraternity party with her sister.
Mm.
And by her admission, she let her guard down. She drank a little bit too much, a little bit too fast. She said, obviously, her tolerance had lowered since she'd left college. Mm. We know college is good for drinking practice. And during that night, Brock Turner had made advances to her, but she pushed him away.
Yep.
She wasn't interested. So Turner, the accused, admitted he had been actively looking for someone to hook up with.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed he didn't remember how he and the victim ended up behind the dumpster.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to run away once the bikers saw them and stopped to investigate.
Yep.
They chased him down and they tackled him. Mm. So they then called the police. The bikers did. They arrived. They arrested Turner. He was also intoxicated, but reportedly remembered everything that had occurred that night, while the woman remained unresponsive at the scene.
Yeah, so I assume from what you say that, I mean, if you're riding past a dumpster and there's two people having sex, you don't know it's a rape, but presumably she was unconscious.
Oh, so yes, she was unconscious.
So then that's quite clearly going to be a rape since she can't consent when she's unconscious.
Yes, and so she was taken to hospital
and
she didn't regain consciousness until a little while later.
Jeepers, she was pretty drunk.
She was out of it. After he was charged, Turner's counsel felt that they had a case for consent, that she was consenting to the act. Since both parties were intoxicated at the time of the assault, her blood alcohol concentration came back as 3 times the legal limit.
Mm.
Turner's was 2 times the legal limit.
Mm.
So defense argued that the encounter was consensual by both of them. The victim said she never gave any kind of consent. Mm. The prosecution held that he was aware that she was drunk and knowingly took advantage of her.
Mm.
In their closing arguments, they said that he was the face of campus sexual assault. Defense claimed that she had consented and he'd only run away because he felt sick from the alcohol he had consumed.
Mm.
So he was convicted by a jury of that assault.
That doesn't sound like a great defense argument.
No, with intent to commit rape, penetration of an intoxicated person, and penetration of an unconscious person. Mm. They were the three charges.
Mm.
I read her victim impact statement. It was very long, but it is heartbreaking.
Mm.
She said directly to him, "You don't know me, but you've been inside of me, and that's why we're here today."
Mm.
It was a very powerful statement. Turner himself wrote a letter to the sentencing judge, which was read during his sentencing. I've also read that. It is a little bit me, what impact it's had on him and how sorry he feels and his life will never be the same.
Mm.
He blamed alcohol and the party culture on campus for the sexual assault. His father also wrote a letter to the court pleading for leniency and sentencing, as any jail time would be too harsh.
Mm.
He referred to the rape in this way. So this is what the dad wrote.
Said, yes.
"His life will never be the one that he dreamed about and worked so hard to achieve. That is a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of his 20 plus years of life."
Mm.
And that just disgusts me.
Mm, yeah, it's not a great turn of phrase.
What sentence did Brock Turner get? So prosecution submitted a sentence of 6 years imprisonment would be appropriate.
Mm.
What he got was 6 months in prison. And
head sentence, 6 months.
Yes.
Wow.
And 3 years probation and a lifetime on the sex offender register.
Yep.
The judge said that a longer prison term would have a severe impact on Turner.
Yep.
The maximum he could have received was 14 years in prison, and there was outrage about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 6 years sounds about right in Australia or in Queensland. That's about what you'd be getting as a head sentence, I would have suspected, on a first offence. 6 months. Yeah, 6 months is just
And he didn't even serve all of that.
And so it goes on appeal or not?
Well, the judge, I think, got removed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, that was the sentence that he got.
Yeah.
Next, we have the Vanderbilt University rape case. And again, this is one you probably would remember.
Mm.
So there were four Vanderbilt students, footballers, and they were convicted of multiple offences of sexual assault and rape back in 2013. Oh, they were committed in 2013. The trials and sentencing came sometime later.
Yes.
Very different penalties here. One of the offenders got 17 years.
Yeah.
One of them got 15 years. Two of them got 15 years. A fourth, who was not actively participating but was a party, got 10 years probation.
Yeah.
So these offenses were committed after a night of heavy drinking at a bar. Vandenberg was the primary offender. He and the victim had been dating for a short time, and they were drinking together, and they got back to the dorm room at 2:30 a.m. So this is on residential campus. Hallway surveillance cameras captured Vandenberg and three other players carrying her to his room just after 2:30.
Mm.
At 3:09, Vandenberg covered the hallway camera with a towel. And that was then removed 17 minutes later. So I don't know what they were covering up, but clearly they knew that there was something wrong happening.
Mm.
Throughout the investigation, because there was a complaint made, police found more than 40 images and three videos of what took place in that bedroom. So it showed, the video footage showed the players dragging her unconscious down the dorm hallway while giggling, snapping photos and videos and pausing to inspect her naked body.
Mm.
Once inside the dorm room, one of them penetrated her with a water bottle while another was encouraging him.
Mm.
One urinated on her and made a racial statement. Another passed out condoms before assaulting her. Her clothes were taken off. One man penetrated her with his fingers. Another touched her vagina, taking close-up photos with his phone.
Mm.
Just horrific.
Mm.
Such abuse of this poor woman. Through this time, he sent Vandenberg, the main guy, sent a number of text messages and at least one photo of the victim to another player. He shared the recording of that night with friends. And afterwards, these men were texting each other about the attack and how to cover it up. So it was different, very different in terms of the commission of the offending and the gravity of the offending.
Yeah, which seems to have been recognised by the court because they're very, I mean, they're heavy sentences.
Yes.
For a first offence in a rape case. Yes. But, I mean, it's just a horrible set of facts.
So she woke up. She wasn't really sure where she was. She felt out of it. She was confused. She was sick and nauseous. She had pain in her limbs. Her knee was bleeding.
Mm.
She found vomit in her hair, bruising. Mm. She went back to her apartment, didn't realise the full extent or really what had happened to her. And when police contacted her 3 days later, she said she told them what Vandenberg had told her,
right,
which was that she'd gotten sick in his room. He'd had to clean it up. It was horrible. He'd had to spend the night taking care of her. And she apologized to him and was embarrassed about her behavior.
Wow.
So that was her initial recount to police. Police got into it because they'd shared all of the
footage and someone gave it to the police.
Look, a lot you could say about that, but I think the common theme is alcohol, young people.
Yep.
And this college, university lifestyle. You know, you don't have to get up and go to work every day. Responsibilities are less.
Yep.
You know, it's a party life. And this seems to be a consequence.
Mm.
I did read one of the guys apologized after he was convicted, but went on to say he was too drunk to remember the incident, having blacked out after drinking 14 to 22 drinks that night. And he told the court he only realized what he'd done when he saw the photos the next morning on his way to church.
Wow.
Okay. The university response to that, the head coach of the football team was contacted while he was on holidays by the guys and told about the incident. He held a team meeting that same night, warning the men to take this investigation seriously, but also to shut it down. So they knew from the outset. They went and spoke to the victim, the head coach and the head of recruiting. And according to a court filing, she said they came and talked to her because they cared about her, because she assisted them with recruiting. When she was asked what she meant, she said she had been asked by these guys, these men, to get 15 pretty girls together and form a team to assist with the recruiting, even though he knew it was against the rules. So maybe a little bit like using them as a lure to get guys in.
Okay.
And so...
interesting strategy.
Yes, yes. So she and others said there was a culture that encouraged sexual promiscuity and a culture of alcohol and alcohol consumption. And it was that combination of things which ended in, well, and the decisions of these men involved. Obviously, the US, there's an issue in, you know, frat parties and all of that. We see it in movies and that sort of thing. But we've also got issues here in Australia. So one example I've got for you is from a residential college in Adelaide. So there was an investigation into that college that was being conducted, and the results were released in 2018. Subject of media attention. There were over 200 explicit photos, videos, and documents sent in from past students and verified, including one story from a past student that I found pretty bad. So she described her first night at the college, revealing that she was assaulted in her room and forced to have sex with a third year student. She said this had happened straight after, in orientation, she had been taken on a sex tour of the campus. Apparently a sex tour involved being taken through the college into a variety of rooms where there were couples who appeared to be having sex in the open. In the library, there was hardcore porn displayed on a big screen, and boys appeared to be masturbating while watching that.
Wow. Is this a uni? Is this a boys and girls college?
Yes.
Okay.
And apparently this was a normal part of the O-week hazing, orientation week hazing. And so then she was taken back to the room and had sex with this guy, and she'd never told anyone until this investigation because she blamed herself for not saying no, for not pushing him out of her room. And she said she was actually just also overwhelmed by everything she'd just seen.
Yeah.
You know, so another student revealed that she was sexually, she was made to undress for older male students as part of the sex tour. Another told her she'd been sexually assaulted after passing out following a night of excessive drinking and a friend had shown her photos that had been taken of her while she was unconscious. A group of men crowded around her. She was down to her underwear and they were touching her in different parts of her body, including her breasts. One of those students said that she had reported the offending. She had bruising as well as mental trauma, and it fell on deaf ears. She said that the official response to her was, it's all just part of growing up.
So this is in the report comes out 2018. So this is 2017 that it occurs and she makes.
Well, I don't know. There was anonymity for a lot of these students, but the investigation had been, you know, had asked past students.
Yeah. Okay.
60 Minutes picked it up. College leadership initially denied there was a problem, but after 60 Minutes aired their story, they released a statement saying that viewers had been given a very distorted, misleading, and sensationalized picture of the college.
From 60 Minutes, really?
Completely rejecting that a toxic culture existed. They did finally accept the truth of what had been alleged by one particular student, and they wrote her a letter telling her that action had been taken against the current students. This was a current student.
Yeah.
And that action, the consequence, a 3-hour workshop on gender equity, sexual harassment, and what it means to be an ethical bystander.
Mm-hmm. You obviously feel that's insufficient. I mean, could they actually catch the person, you know, who was involved in the sexual congress?
They were told to do that 3-hour workshop.
Or was the whole college? I mean, it sounds like a case for the police, really. But you know, I mean, if they actually catch the person and they can identify them, I would have thought a 3-hour seminar is probably not enough. But you know, if it's, I was taken around for a hazing, I saw people having sex, I saw men masturbating, I saw hardcore porn, I was all very uncomfortable. And it sort of finishes there.
No, this is one of the girls who assaulted. Said,
right, okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, if they actually catch the person who assaulted them, I think 3 hours, I agree with you, 3 hours seminar is not enough at all.
It's nothing.
One would have thought some kind of suspension or termination.
Expulsion,
from the college. Yeah, I mean, I've seen people expelled for less.
So those were all a little bit dated, 2018 or earlier. So I did a little bit more digging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably it's important to note the difference. So sexual violence, some of the terminology we're going to use today, sexual violence refers to the occurrence, attempt or threat of sexual assault and is measured by combining experiences of sexual assault and sexual threat. Sexual assault itself is an act of a sexual nature carried out against a person's will through the use of physical force or intimidation or coercion, including any attempts to do this, and will include rape, attempted rape, aggravated sexual assault, which is with a weapon, indecent assault, penetration by objects, forced sexual activity that did not end in penetration, and attempts to force a person into sexual activity.
See, I find using definitions that aren't legal definitions can really confuse the issue. I don't know why they just didn't go with, I mean, there is a definition for sexual assault. There is a definition for rape. Why don't they just use them?
Well, so I took those definitions from the Personal Safety Survey, which was a national initiative.
But again, why did the Personal Safety Survey change the definition?
Because I don't think that there are consistent definitions across all the states. So this was national.
Right.
So you can't make reference to Queensland law and have somebody in Victoria know that that's the correct definition.
Yeah, I think you could do a better job than they've done based on the stuff you just read out. And sexual violence, again, I've seen a survey where the definition of sexual violence was very different from that. So I appreciate what you say, and I think it's very important we understand what the definitions are in these reports when they say sexual assault, sexual violence. But I think you have to look at the report to see how they define it.
You're coming at this as a lawyer, but we're also, these were university students who were being surveyed They don't know the law.
They don't need to know the law. You tell them what the definition is. Did this happen to you? Were you penetrated without consent? Yes, no. You know, that's, they don't need to know that that's a rape. You can just say, you know. So, okay. And I think it's important in that this stuff is then published, hence we're talking about it. And, you know, these things go before attorneys general meetings and they go in and they form part of policy considerations and decisions that are made. And, you know, these reports, the, you know, from the Australian Human Rights Commission, the Sex Discrimination Commissioner, they then are used as motivations to change the law. And I'm not necessarily saying the law should be changed, but I'm saying if that's what, if that is the end that they are going to be put to, then they need to start with legal definitions.
Okay, but I don't think that this personal safety survey was aimed at legislative reform really? So much.
They just did it for fun?
No, they did it for universities and colleges and working out what kinds of issues we have on campuses and working out what actions need to be taken by university institutions.
Yeah. Well,
so that's not the same as taking it to police and charging it.
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, if there's offences that come to light, absolutely people should be investigated
this
and charged.
This is what but kind of conduct are people being subjected to on a campus?
Yeah, and I don't know what report you're talking about. The one I looked at was done by the Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission.
Was that the National Student
Sex Discrimination Commission? I didn't. Yeah, it's the National Report on Sexual Assault and Harassment at Australian Universities.
So there was a 2016 or 2017 report, yeah, and then a 2021.
Yeah. Yes.
So I've looked a little bit at the 2021
one. But it's the same. It's the Sex Discrimination Commissioner.
I think so.
So that's a government.
I looked at the National Student Safety Survey.
Anyway, we don't need to descend into that. But,
all right.
But my point is I always think it's very important to be very careful about exactly what they're talking about when they use these terms like sexual assault, sexual violence, like what exactly they mean, because they do tend to change the definitions between reports or people use the words in different ways.
Well, an act of a sexual nature carried out against a person's will, that is the essence of a sexual assault as we...
What is an act of a sexual nature?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Well, what's an indecent dealing? What?
But that doesn't even cover a touching. An act of a sexual nature.
What do you mean it doesn't cover a touching?
Well, I make a sexual gesture towards you. I mean, that could fall under that definition. Okay. You know, I make some lewd gesture with my tongue towards you. You go, well, it's an act of a sexual nature without my consent and it offends me. Boom, I'll tick yes on that.
All right. So let me tell you the results. Okay.
Okay.
In the 2021 to 2022 reporting year, 22% of women, 6.1% of men have experienced sexual violence, which translates to 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men. Doesn't factor in any offending against a child under 15 years of age. So all of these questions are since the age of 15.
So this wasn't specific to university students?
This was just general.
Just general.
This was just general. It's a simple fact, more women are victim to sexual violence than men. Doesn't diminish the impact on men at all, but it is a statistical finding. In terms of gender of offender, 2.2 million perpetrators were men. 67,000 were women. So much greater proportion of offenders. In terms of age of the victims of the 22% of women who were victims, more than half were aged between 18 to 24 years. And so that brings us back to our college university demographic. Now, in the National Student Safety Survey undertaken in 2021 of, I think it was 39 universities who agree or who are part of a group.
I think there's only 39 in Australia, aren't there?
Oh, well, they must all be Universities Australia. So it was funded by Universities Australia. 43,819 students took part. And the results revealed one in six students had experienced sexual harassment since starting uni. One in 20 had been sexually assaulted. Out of those, one in 30 harassed students made a formal complaint, and one in 20 sexually assaulted students made a formal complaint.
So, what I'm taking from what you said is low reporting rates.
Low reporting rates. Now, the demographic most likely to suffer harassment and assault at university are transgender and non-binary persons, closely followed by women. So,
that's interesting.
Yes.
Did they posit any reasons for that?
No, they didn't. Okay. They didn't. I think there's still perhaps some archaic opinions floating around.
Well, I took what you said that it was sexual violence, which you gave the definition for, which seemed to exclude just ordinary violence.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it's offences or these kind of breaches against trans people is of a sexual nature.
For this survey, yes.
For that survey, yeah.
Yeah. There was a similar kind of report from the US, what they call campus sexual violence, and their research identifies that women at college are three times more likely to experience sexual violence than men.
Okay.
All right. So, you know, I don't doubt the truth of these kinds of statistics. You might quibble over the definitions, but I think...
Well, I don't know what you mean by the truth of them. You say the statistics are reliable.
Well, I think so.
They paint an accurate picture.
I think so.
Okay.
You know, I think it's probably even more than this reveals, because there are so many victims who maybe don't even realize that what has happened to them is an offense. They feel embarrassed or ashamed or to blame, and so they don't tell people.
So they don't fill out the survey, is that what you're saying? 43,000, and then there's an extra group who were so upset or traumatized by the event that they didn't even fill the survey out.
I think for sure. I think with all sexual offending, there is going to be a proportion of victims that we never hear about.
Sure. Oh, I think that's the case with all offending. I saw some stats before I came here, and I can't speak to the validity of these stats, but they were interesting. It said that fraud was the most common offence nowadays, which I found strange, not in my experience. But then it said 86% of frauds are never reported. So then I thought, well, how is it that they say fraud is the most common offence? But anyway, 86% never reported, and there were, of the ones that are reported, 7% are investigated, and of the ones that are reported, only 1% are ever prosecuted. So the idea that there are low reporting rates, I don't think is atypical. I think it's probably similar for a lot of offences.
Oh, that's right. But so then when you think about one in five women.
I thought it was one in six at university.
One in six. I think that's an underrepresentation of the reality. I mean, I know you
say that, but I mean, how do we? I mean, we can work off statistics and we can argue about the validity of the statistics. I can't argue against you saying, yeah, but there's more of them. We just can't. Yeah, you know, we just don't know about them. I mean, how can anyone respond to that?
Well, because that's our experience of sex offending, is that victims are often reluctant to come forward.
Sure.
And so,
but they're not coming forward. This is a survey that is presumably voluntary. Students, you can fill the survey out if you want. We then from that deduce that there is a level of that they fill the survey out, so they report it on the survey. They admit on the survey that they've experienced the sexual violence or the sexual assault, and then haven't reported it to university authorities or the police. So we can get a sense then of the size or the problem. But I mean, as soon as you're saying, oh, and there's a whole hidden demographic we don't even know about, it's like, well, what can we do with that? Do we know it's even statistically relevant? I mean, it could be so small that we don't need to bother about it. I don't know.
So small. Let's okay. So now you're not going to like the next bit.
Okay.
But this idea of mine that it is underreported and underdisclosed, I think, is illustrated by what happened in 2021 when a woman called Chanel Kontos put up an Instagram poll that asked for testimonials from young Australian women who had been sexually assaulted while at private Sydney educational.
Was it limited to that way? I thought it was just it had started been sexually like assaulted that. At school it's, or something.
It started with Sydney schools, I think. So she uncovered over 6,000 stories about sexual abuse and coercion in high school and college, many of them Sydney's elite private schools. And she used those stories to highlight how schools are not educating our students effectively in terms of consent and related issues there. So she talks a lot about Australian rape culture, and I think nowhere is that possibly more prevalent than with young males.
Interesting. So I knew you were going to talk about this because you told me. So for those watching on YouTube, you can see a copy of the book, which I went out and bought because Lizzie said she was going to talk about it, so I thought I should read it. And how do you say her surname? Kontos. Chantel Kontos needs to be congratulated for obviously an enormous amount of work that she has put in terms of seeking to increase the level of education that is given in high schools in relation to consent. And that, based on what she says in the book, was a realization that came to her when she, as a 15-year-old at school, was given a talk about what consent means, and she and her friends only at that point realized that they had all been victims of rape or sexual assault in dealings that they'd had with their, you know, boyfriends or other people at school. And so that that fired her up and other things and the Instagram posts that she's put up to then create this organization which goes around and tries to make sure that consent is taught better at schools. I think that is all excellent and very admirable. She then goes on to link it to wider cultural problems, and I think that the rationale for that in her book is not laid out particularly well. If it exists, then I think she needs to do a better job of expressing that.
If it exists, meaning if rape culture
exists in this country, she needs to do a better job of expressing that, yes.
I thought she did a good job. I loved the bit where she said the types of experiences you might have at age 10, 12, 15, all the way up to 30s and 40s.
Mm.
Little things like being wolf whistled, having your ass grabbed, having sex when you're too tired, but you feel you have to, you know, these perceptions of duty and obligation and not being able to say no or accepting certain things. Because that's just what boys are like, or that's men, or men have needs. All of these things that, you shouldn't wear that. Don't wear a tight dress. You know, all of this stuff that is just inherent in our culture.
Well, I'm sure that parts of it were at some point. I'm not sure that much of that exists nowadays. I have not seen or heard anybody wolf whistle. I mean, nobody obviously wolf whistles at me, unfortunately, but I have never seen or heard somebody wolf whistle in a very long time. I wolf whistled at my wife after I dropped her off once, but I'm not a very good wolf whistler. But, you know, I don't know that occurs anymore. Certainly the idea that you would say to a young person now, you shouldn't wear that. I mean, I balk at saying that to my own daughters. You know, and if I think that it's a bit inappropriate, I whisper to my wife, do you think maybe they should, you know, I'm not even going to say it to them. You know, I think.
No, but I think it hasn't been that long since things like what a victim was wearing formed part of the evidence in a case at trial. So I can remember seeing it in plastic bags, part of the evidence that they were wearing this skirt or these undies or whatever it was. And that's not that long ago. And I think we still have an issue of a rape or sexual assault victim being put on trial to an extent when they make a complaint. But
All victims. I agree that the process, the investigative process, is very difficult for victims of rape and sexual assault, but it is the same process for every offence.
But it's not as invasive and traumatic for an offence of a property crime, for example, or, you know, unlawful use of a motor vehicle, or, you know, whatever. It's different. But we're getting sidetracked. That's a different episode.
Yeah.
All right. So this idea of rape culture, I think, is relevant and we can disagree. But I think also like the people who are impacted by it are women, people with disabilities, members of the LGBTQIA+ community, you know. And so I think whatever advances we might have made, there are still elements present and sinister in treatment of some of these people. So, and I think in universities where there is a lot of drinking and a lot of group mentality and lowered inhibitions and no responsibilities and all of that sort of thing, I think it comes to the forefront.
Yeah, but I mean, in some senses, and I'm not saying that the university shouldn't have policies around this and shouldn't try and discourage, you know, teach consent and discourage any of these kind of, you know, what are illegal behaviours. I absolutely think I should. But, I mean, you know, the idea that young people who, you know, as you point out, are sort of footloose and fancy free and, you know, drink alcohol and go to parties, you know, and are engaging in sexual activities, you know, it's one of the, you know, benefits of sort of being young and free.
Okay.
And so, of course, that's going to be the area where, you know, there's more of this kind of stuff goes on. I mean, I haven't been in a nightclub on a dance floor for 30 years.
Okay, but so I take issue right there with you saying, of course, that's where we're going to see more of this activity. And I think that's the problem, this sort of broad acceptance that it's going to happen. No, it has to stop.
Sorry, I accept that this kind of behaviour, the criminal behaviour they're talking about, absolutely has to. I accept that, but I don't know why anybody would be surprised that it's statistically more likely at a university. So of course it's statistically more likely at a university. That's when they're engaging in sex. That's when they're drinking alcohol.
But
they're
not doing it
when they're in long-term monogamous relationships and have children.
But I think that very kind of idea of, oh, it's more likely to happen, that's what has to change. We have to, like, I just have a list that goes on and on of people who have been subject to inappropriate conduct or criminal offences.
Yeah.
And in a place where they should feel safe and where any kind of, oh, God, or, you know, it's uni, like that's not.
I don't think that should, I'm not saying that that's an excuse for the behaviour. I'm saying it's an explanation for the behaviour. And I think when you start reading a list of 40 examples you've got, you need to put that in the context of the fact that there's 39 universities in this country. You know, University of Queensland has 30,000 students. I mean, there would be more than 200,000 students at university, I think, easily at any one time. And so you read out a list of 40 examples. I mean, I'm not saying it shouldn't be stopped and I'm not saying we shouldn't do something about it. I completely agree. But to say that 40 examples out of 200,000 equals rape culture, I just think is...
Oh, I've only got this many. There are more out there. There's more than that.
I think what you say is useful and important, and Australian universities should definitely do something about it. But to then expand that to some global idea that, you know, we've got a rape culture in Australia, I don't think that rationally makes sense.
I don't know, Joe. I think you're quick to dismiss rape culture, but then I also have to wonder how much of that is because you are a man, you are white, you are privileged.
Sure.
I don't want to say middle-aged because I think we're still young.
I'm probably past middle-aged. I'm not going to live to over 100. Look, I accept that. Yeah, my identity and who I am absolutely feeds into my opinions. Of course it does, just as your identity feeds into yours. I hope, though, that I can accept my biases and you know, try and factor that into the things that I think. You know, so I just think the idea that there's some kind of a rape culture – I just think is pushing the evidence way too far.
I think we're not out of the woods when it comes to a healthy attitude towards
I agree.
Women, minorities, trans. I think we have a way to go. Mm. And I think that's because maybe don't call it rape culture, but maybe call it the current culture, which still does not adequately value the things that will eradicate that kind of discrimination, bias, and offending. I mean, anyway.
Well, one of the things that this topic made me think about is a movie, Starship Troopers. Have you ever seen Starship Troopers? Oh, I love it. It's a fantastic movie. So set in the future, it was a late 90s film, I think. Anyway, it's set in the future, and it really doesn't revolve around this scene at all, but the scene is always sort of, it struck me at the time and has since. You know, the future is this sort of quite militaristic society where people join the army and go and fight bugs on other planets to, you know, gain citizenship. That part's not really relevant. But, you know, the story follows these three kids who all graduate school together and they go and do basic training together. And there's a scene in basic training where they, you know, it's a way of introducing all the characters that they're doing basic training with. And it is in the showers. So you probably remember the TV show MASH, and a lot of the scenes happen when the two doctors are in the showers talking to each other. But that was two male doctors obviously talking to each other. This was unisex showers. So the men and the women were there together. So that immediately strikes you as odd because they're all in these sort of military showers and they're all just talking absolutely normally, completely normally, like there is nothing strange about this at all. And at the time I was like, what is that? But then I reflected and I thought, you know, this script writer or this novelist, his vision of the future is that male and female relationships can be so normalized and they can treat each other as equals that they could shower together and it not be an issue, that nobody ever touches anybody and everyone treats each other with respect and dignity. And I thought that's a really interesting, you know, a vision of the future to aim for.
And I think we're not there yet.
No, absolutely not. No.
So I guess where I wanted to take this is to think about what universities should do as a response to the results of the safety survey. I mean, we've had instances where there have been serious failures by institutions to take action. So, for example, University of Tasmania allowed a guy called Nicholas Bester to remain enrolled and on campus. He was the former high school teacher who was convicted of raping the 2021 Australian of the Year, Grace Tame.
Oh, wow.
So he was dealt with for that crime and went to prison and he was released. And when he was released, he got charged again with child exploitation materials because he wrote comments on social media about his sexual relationship with a former student, describing it as awesome and enviable. And yet he was allowed to remain enrolled in his PhD. Like there was no no consequence there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that must have been against some kind of behavioural code of conduct.
You'd think. And that was just recently, you know. Yeah. There was a male student accused of stalking, watching one woman shower and sexually assaulting another who was then hired as a tutor by UQ despite a temporary protection order having been issued against him by one of his victims. The sex tours of the colleges and reports of administrators of the colleges looking the other way. And also problems with TEXA, which is the Tertiary Education Qualification Standard Authority or something like that.
I don't know. Yeah.
They apparently undertook at least 60 investigations into complaints and registration assessments about sexual violence between 2017 and 2022. But not a single university faced enforcement action, despite TEXA being able to impose administrative sanctions, fines, or put conditions on their registrations. So they investigated 60 and not a single one of them had a consequence.
Yeah.
So there has been a suggestion since the 2021 National Safety Report was released for universities to be more proactive, put in place better protections, processes, that sort of thing. So some unis have said that their hands are tied when it comes to taking action, that the colleges are independent, they have their own processes. They don't have any say in what happens in those residential colleges, that sort of thing.
Which is sort of probably true, but also not true, because presumably the colleges have some kind of agreement with the university, which the university can use as leverage.
There was also a big push for, or there is currently a big push for, an independent ombudsman so that students would have an external process.
Yes.
So there was a huge pitch for it at some meetings in November 2023, and the Universities Australia said that they would consult on that, but they expressed concern that such a body would have too much power and would create duplication and overlap with existing regulations, which I think is not true.
Well, there's ombudsmans in lots of things, you know, telecommunications ombudsman.
Oh, I thought it meant with university processes, which I think is the problem.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of duplications, as I said, there's lots of ombudsmans who presumably duplicate what
other
what companies do themselves in their own.
I think that's actually a good idea, a national ombudsman. Yeah. Anyway,
who pays for it though? That's the problem. The university is like, yeah, we don't want to pay.
The government should pay.
Okay.
There has been some positive moves. University of Melbourne, Monash, ANU, Macquarie, Swinburne, Curtin, others are publishing detailed sexual misconduct reports annually. One of the issues was the transparency, but others are not publishing at all or are publishing only limited information. So there definitely isn't consensus among the 39 universities of the best way forward.
No, sure. But again, I mean, particularly after COVID, there were a number of universities in this country that were struggling financially. And to publish an annual report is an expensive, you know, exercise, not just the printing and the, you know, formatting, but the investigation and the writing. You know, it's an expensive exercise.
I also think it's worth it. I think it's worth it.
Yeah. Well, that really came back to my, you know, whether, you know, whether it's worth it, I can't answer. But you can't get a sense of that from the statistics you've given, because you need to understand what are the other things that are facing the universities in terms of their, you know, in terms of their finances. What are the other problems facing universities in terms of, you know, cheating, for example, or just assault, not even sexual assault. So.
Look, I went to college.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed it.
Yes.
But I look back and I think some of the stuff that happened really should never have happened. A lot of nudity, a lot of, you know, inappropriate conduct.
Yeah.
My nieces and nephews have recently attended college and there is some change to the acceptance of the drinking culture. I think the drinking culture is still there, but I know, for example, one of my relatives, one of my nieces or nephews, told me of a girl at college who got raped, and she told the university, and she identified him, and they spoke to him, and he was reprimanded, but nothing else, and she left university because she couldn't cope. And I think that is why we keep pushing, even at a cost, because that culture is, or that response is not okay.
No, I mean, it's a crime. That should have just been reported to the police.
It should have been reported to the police, and at the very least, he should have been, you know, asked to leave.
Probably
anyway.
Suspended while an police investigation occurred, and then. But look, I must say, I think so. One of the, you say to me, well, I don't know, you know, so you can't understand why I don't think there's a rape culture, and part of the reason is because that's not been my personal experience. Now you point out, well, that's because you're a white male, and there may well be something in that. But I went to university and I had a great time, and in fact, university I think nowadays is actually more, you know, rigid in terms of the rules than it were and was in my day, because when I was at college, we had same-sex dormitories. So you had your own bedroom, but you were lived in a corridor with men and women, boys and girls, and you shared a bathroom. I mean, there were individual cubicles in the bathroom. So that university now doesn't do that. They have unisex dorms. It's only girls in a dormitory, only boys in a, you know, dormitory.
I think there have been positive changes in some respects, but I think there's just less open binge drinking and hazing and O-week activities.
Yeah.
I think before, admin or exec may have maybe turned a blind eye. Now it's more secretive, but it still happens.
Yeah.
All right, I just want to finish on and this is, I'm being a bit naughty here, because when I was doing all of this research, I stumbled across this woman who I just cannot even fathom. Mm. But I think in terms of hearing divergent views, oh my goodness, she is polar opposite to me.
Yep.
So her name is Bettina Arndt.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of it, yeah.
Yes. So she's got a blog. Now, she has received some kind of award for her work with men and men's rights, and I'm not taking away from that, but I think she's gone way too far.
Okay.
So she's got a blog. She provides a little blurb about herself, and it says, "Alarmed by the unfair treatment of men in our society, Bettina now writes an influential blog on denouncing feminism and advocating for men's rights." Mm. She provides support for falsely accused men on campuses and elsewhere. Mm. So it's a bit of her cause célèbre.
Yes.
I actually felt myself getting so worked up when I was reading her blog. And I will say, of course there are false allegations. That happens. I have seen it in court, been uncovered or admitted to. I don't think they are as common as Bettina would have us
believe. Yeah.
But look, she's written some very good books you might also like to buy, The Sex Diaries and What Men Want in Bed. So I think she's really got a perspective.
Read. Yeah.
But she talks in that book about, not that I read it, but I read the blurb,
yeah,
why sex means so much to men, reveals what it's like for men to live with constant sparking sexual energy that is relentless, uncontrollable, and all-consuming.
Yeah.
And I just think that perspective right there is part of the problem.
Well, having been a young male, I can tell you it's not a perspective.
But to say it's relentless and uncontrollable.
Well, uncontrollable, you know what I mean? Like that, relentless, certainly.
It's setting up that narrative, Joe, you know?
Well, I don't think that it's something that you should, you could just be dismissed. I mean, the level of testosterone in young males and the sexual urges that it creates are enormous. I agree, they're not uncontrollable.
But you have to control it.
No, I absolutely agree with that. But I think it is something that should be understood. Yeah.
But so I wanted to finish with what she said and say she is wrong.
Yes.
But she read about false rape allegations. Mm. She said, "What muddies the waters is the massive expansion of the type of behavior now classified as sexual assault. There's a steady stream of cases now finding their way into court which involve young couples where a girl may suddenly decide that she hadn't given consent on one occasion after having sex when she was half asleep or pretty drunk, even though they might have done this dozens of times before. It makes no sense." And to me, that encapsulates what is wrong with attitudes towards sex offending.
Mm.
Because to me, that is what happens. Girls are unconscious, or victims are unconscious. Or
I don't think she said unconscious. She said intoxicated.
Or because they've said yes before,
then
they should. So I just want to say, Bettina, you are problematic.
Well,
in my opinion.
Mean, in the marketplace of ideas that we have in our Western culture where we discuss all these different things, I mean, I appreciate you disagree with her and I don't necessarily agree with her either. But I think having perspectives like that, or having perspectives like Chantel Contos is out there, you know, even if you disagree with them, it's super
we
important.
We need the discourse.
Yeah.
One reviewer did say, "Fell into Bettina Arndt's blog by accident and am now bleaching my brain." Me too.
Wow. All right. Thank you, Lizzie, for an interesting topic once again.
No worries. Well, lovely.
See you
week.
Next time. Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.